in the financial fortress you built on a transgression. And yet, still it stands. She closed her eyes and opened them again instantly. She was tired, but wide awake. She felt all pop-eyed, like she was on coke. So this was insomnia. She'd always thought she wasn't the type for it. She felt a sudden need to go check on Dakota. She wasn't the type for that either. She hadn't been one of those mothers who go in to check her sleeping baby is still breathing. She'd caught Vid doing it a few times. He'd been a little shamefaced. Mr. I'm so cool and casual and this is my fourth kid. She got out of bed, her arms outstretched, and expertly shuffled her way to the door jamb, which always turned up sooner than she expected. It was much easier to see once she got out on the landing, because they always left a light on, turned down low, in case Dakota got up in the night. She pushed Dakota's bedroom door open and stood there for a moment, letting her eyes adjust. Tiffany couldn't hear anything over the rain. She wanted to hear the even sound of Dakota breathing. She tiptoed forward, past the crammed bookshelf, and stood next to the bed, looking down at Dakota, trying to make out the form of her body. Dakota appeared to be lying flat on her back, just like her father, although usually she slept curled up on her side. At the same moment she registered the twin shimmers of Dakota's eyes staring up at her, she heard Dakota say in a perfectly clear, wide-awake voice, "What's the matter, Mum?" Tiffany jumped and yelped. "I thought you were asleep," she said, pressing her hand to her chest. "You gave me the fright of my life." "I'm not asleep," said Dakota. "Can't you sleep? Why are you lying there awake like that? What's the matter?" "Nothing," said Dakota. "I'm just awake." "Is something worrying you? Move over." Dakota moved over and Tiffany got into bed with her, feeling an immediate comfort she hadn't known she craved. "Are you upset about Harry?" said Tiffany. Dakota had responded to the news of Harry's death in the same impassive way she now responded to everything. "Not really," said Dakota flatly. "Not that much." "No? Well, we didn't know him very well and he wasn't very nice," finished Dakota. "No, he wasn't. But is there something else?" said Tiffany. "Something on your mind?"
"There's nothing on my mind," said Dakota. "Nothing at all."
She sounded absolutely certain of this, and Dakota had never been able to lie. "You're not worried about going to St. Anastasia's tomorrow?" said Tiffany.
"No," said Dakota.
"It should be interesting," said Tiffany vaguely. She could feel sleep tugging at her consciousness like a drug. Maybe it was nothing. Prepubescent stuff. Hormones. Growing up. "Shall I just lie here until you fall asleep?" said Tiffany.
"If you want," said Dakota frostily.
Dakota's mother lay sound asleep next to her, not snoring exactly, but making a long, thin whistling sound each time she breathed out. Long strands of her mum's hair floated across Dakota's face and tickled her nose. She had hooked one leg over Dakota's leg, locking her close, like she had her in a leg cuff. Holding her breath, Dakota inched her leg free. She pulled back the covers and got up on her knees and flattened herself against the bedroom wall, like Spider-Man. She slid her way down the wall to the end of the bed. It was a covert operation. She was escaping her captor. Yes, she'd done it. She tiptoed across her bedroom, avoiding the landmines in the carpet. Stupid stuff.
Don't think stupid little kid thoughts like that, Dakota, when there are real wars happening right now and real refugees in tiny boats in the middle of the ocean and real people stepping on landmines. Would you like to step on a landmine? She sat on her cushioned window seat and hugged her knees to her chest. She tried to feel gratitude for her window seat, but she felt nothing about her window seat. Instead, she actually thought the terribly rude, ungrateful thought, "I don't give a shit about this window seat." Dakota had not properly understood until recently how her brain was a private space with only her in it. Yesterday, she'd looked at her teacher and screamed the F word in her head. Nothing happened. Nobody knew she'd done that. Nobody would ever know. Everybody else probably worked this out when they were like 3 years old. But it was a revelation to Dakota. Thinking about it made her feel as if she were all alone in a circle-shaped room. Circle-shaped because her head was circle-shaped, with two little round windows, which were her eyes, and people tried to look in to understand her by looking through her eyes, but they couldn't see in. Not really. She was there in her circle-shaped room, all on her own. She could say to her mum, "I love my window seat." And if she'd said it just the right way, not so enthusiastically that she made her suspicious, her mum would think she meant it, and she'd never know the truth. So if Dakota could do that, if Dakota could think shocking, kind of angry, hard thoughts like, "I don't give a shit about window seats," then probably grown-ups had shocking, angry, hard thoughts too, which were probably much worse because they could watch R-rated movies. For example, her mum might say, "Good night, Dakota. I love you, Dakota." But inside the circle-shaped room of her brain, her real self was thinking, "I can't believe you are my daughter, Dakota. I can't believe I have a daughter who would do what you did." Her mother probably thought the reason Dakota had turned out to be such a disappointment was because she was growing up with money. Although, funnily enough, she didn't actually have any money except for some birthday money in a bank account she wasn't allowed to touch. Dakota's mum did not grow up with money. Neither did Dakota's dad, but he didn't go on about that. He just really loved spending it. When Dakota's mum was Dakota's age, she'd gone to a rich kids' party and fallen in love with her house. It was like a castle, she said. She could still describe everything about that house in pretty boring detail. She'd especially loved the window seats. She was obsessed with window seats. They were the height of luxury. For years and years, her mum had dreamed of a two-story house with marble bathrooms and bay windows and window seats. It was a really architecturally specific dream. She had even drawn pictures of it. So when she and Dakota's dad had talked to the builders about this house, they'd said, "Window seats, please. The more, the better." The funny thing was that Dakota had once said something to her Auntie Louise, who was one of her mum's big sisters, about how their family had grown up poor. And her auntie had burst out laughing. "We weren't poor," she said. "We just weren't rich. We had holidays, we had toys, we had a great life. Your mum just thought she didn't belong out here in the lower class suburbs." Then she'd gone and told the other aunties, who'd all teased her mum. But her mum didn't give a shit. She just laughed and said, "Whatever," like she was an American girl on a TV show. Anyway, Dakota still tried her best to love and appreciate her window seats, but she wasn't very good at it. She got, like, 1 out of 10 for appreciation. The blind was down and she didn't want to risk opening it and waking up her mum. so she pulled it over her head like a tent. It was raining outside, so she couldn't see much. Harry's house was just a blurred, spooky shape. She wondered if Harry's ghost was in there, muttering angrily, kicking stuff with the toe of his foot and occasionally turning his head to one side and spitting in disgust. "Why did it take you people so long to find my body? Are you stupid or what?" She wasn't glad he was dead, but she wasn't sad either. She didn't feel anything. There was just a big nothing feeling in her head about Harry. She told her mum the truth when she'd said there was nothing on her mind. She was trying to make her brain like a blank piece of paper. The only thing allowed on her piece of paper was school stuff. Nothing else. Not sad thoughts, not happy thoughts, not scary thoughts. Just facts about Australia's Indigenous culture and global warming and fractions. It was good that she was going to the new school next year. They had a good academic record, so hopefully they would stuff her brain full of more facts so there wouldn't be any room to think about it, to remember what she'd done. Before, she'd felt a bit nervous about starting somewhere new, but now that didn't matter. Remembering her old worries about making friends was like remembering something from when she was only a really little kid, even though the barbecue had only happened back at the end of term two. Her parents still loved her. She was sure of this. They probably weren't thinking secret, angry thoughts. She remembered her dad the day after, standing in the backyard, swinging that big iron bar over and over like a baseball bat, his face bright red. It had been terrifying. Then he'd come inside and had a shower without saying a single word. And her dad liked to talk. Things had to be serious for her dad not to talk. But then, after that, slowly, her mom and dad had returned to their normal selves. They loved her too much not to forgive her. They knew she knew the hugeness of what she'd done. There had been no punishment. That's how big this thing was. It wasn't kid stuff, not like no TV until you tidy your room. Actually, Dakota had never gotten many punishments or consequences. Other kids did heaps of little wrong things every single day of their lives. Dakota just saved it all up and did one giant wrong thing. It was up to her to punish herself. She had thought about cutting herself. She'd read about cutting in a YA book that the librarian said was too old for her, but she'd got her mum to buy it for her. Her mum bought her any book she wanted. Teenagers did it. It was called self-harm. She'd thought she'd try out self-harm, even though she really, really hated blood. When her parents were busy on their computers, she'd gone into their bathroom and found a razor blade and sat on the edge of the bath for ages, trying to get up the courage to press it into her skin. But she couldn't do it. She was too weak, too cowardly. Instead, she hit herself as hard as she could on the top of her thighs with closed fists. Later, there were bruises, so that was good. But then she had come up with a better punishment, something that hurt more than cutting, something that affected her every day and no one even noticed the difference. It made her feel less guilty, but at the same time, it made her feel desolate. Desolate was the most perfectly beautiful word for how she felt. Sometimes she repeated it over and over to herself like a song. Desolate. 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 She wondered for a moment if Harry had felt desolate, and that's why he'd been so angry with everyone. She remembered how that afternoon she'd sat on this window seat reading, and she'd looked up and seen a light on in a room on the second floor of Harry's house, and she'd wondered what Harry was doing up there. And what did he do with all those rooms in that house anyway, when he lived there all alone? Now Harry was dead, and Dakota felt nothing about that. Nothing at all. Chapter 20. The Day of the Barbecue. Here they come! Tiffany called out to Vid in the kitchen as she stood at the front door and watched Dakota walk up the driveway, hand in hand with Clementine's pink tutu-clad daughters, who were skipping by her side. As Tiffany watched, the littler one toppled over in that slow-motion toddler way, and Dakota tried to carry her. The child was about half Dakota's height, so her legs dragged on the ground, and Dakota tilted to one side, staggering under the little girl's weight. "Dakota is being such a good sister," said Tiffany, as Vid appeared at the front door wearing his striped apron, smelling strongly of garlic and lemon from the prawns he was marinating. "Don't even think about it," said Vid. 15 years ago, when he proposed, while Tiffany was still admiring her engagement ring, Tiffany for Tiffany, naturally, Vid had said, "Before you put it on, we need to talk about children, okay?" With three volatile, angry teenage daughters, Vid had no desire for more children, but Tiffany was a young woman, so, of course, she would want children. It was only natural. He understood this. So Vid's compromise in order to close the deal was this. Just one baby. A one-child policy. Like China. He couldn't take any more than that. His heart and his bank account couldn't handle it. He said he would understand if one baby was not enough, but for him, it was not negotiable. Take it or leave it. And by the way, if she walked away, the ring was still hers and he would always love her. Tiffany took the deal. Babies were the last thing on her mind back then, and she really did not fancy stretch marks. She'd never regretted it, except sometimes, like right now, she felt a kind of twinge. Dakota would have been a loving, responsible older sister, just like Tiffany's own older sisters had been. It seemed wrong to deny her that, especially as Dakota never demanded anything except more library books. "Maybe we should renegotiate our deal," said Tiffany.
"Don't even joke about it," said Vid. "I am not laughing. Look at this face." He pulled a mournful face. "Serious face. 4 weddings will bankrupt me. It will be the death of me. It will be like that movie, you know, 4 weddings and a funeral. My funeral." Vid chuckled, delighted with himself. 4 weddings and my funeral. You get it? 4 daughters' weddings and Vid's funeral.
"I get it, Vid," said Tiffany, knowing that she'd be hearing this joke for months, possibly years to come. She watched Erica and Oliver, Clementine and Sam, approach the house behind the children. There was something odd about their formation. There was too much space around them, as if they weren't 2 couples who knew each other well, but 4 individual guests who hadn't met before this day and had happened to arrive at the same time.
"Hi," called out Erica, timing it just a bit wrong. She was too far away. Their driveway was very long.
"Hi," called back Tiffany, walking down the steps to meet them.
As they got closer, she saw they all had identical glazed smiles, like people who have recently gotten into drugs or religion or a new pyramid sales scheme. Tiffany felt a hint of trepidation. How was this afternoon going to pan out?
Vid walked straight past her, towards the guests, his arms outstretched. Jeez Louise, Vid, you peanut. You'd think they were beloved relatives returning from a long trip overseas. Barney thought the guests were his beloved relatives too and rushed to ecstatically sniff everyone's shoes, as though it were a race to get them all sniffed in record time. Welcome, welcome, cried Vid. And look at these beautiful little girls. Hello. I hope you don't mind me sending Dakota over to fetch you. I didn't want the meat to be overcooked. Barney, calm down, you crazy dog.
He kissed Clementine on both cheeks.
Because I remember you're a foodie like me, right? We like good food. Last time we met at Erika's place, I remember we talked food, you know?
Did you? Said Erika suspiciously, as if all conversational topics should have been first cleared with her. I don't remember that. She handed Tiffany a jar of chocolate nuts.
I hope you don't have allergies, because these are nuts. Chocolate nuts.
No allergies, said Tiffany. Actually, I love these.
She wasn't just being polite. They made her feel nostalgic. Her grandfather used to buy them every Christmas.
Really? Said Erika doubtfully. Well, that's good.
She was a real odd bod, that girl, as Tiffany's sister Karen would say. Clementine had lost her glazed expression, and she was looking at Vid as if he were the answer to all her problems.
Mum, this one is Ruby, and this one is Holly. Can I take them up to my room? Said Dakota to Tiffany.
Her eyes shone as she presented the tangle-haired little pixie girls, who wore fairy wings and appeared to have recently upended bottles of glitter all over themselves.
If it's okay with their mum and dad, said Tiffany.
Dakota is very responsible, you know, said Vid. She'll look after them.
Of course it's okay with us, said Sam, as he kissed Tiffany on the cheek, with a well-brought-up Aussie boy flick of his eyes at her body. Up, down, and quick away.
It's great to see you again, Tiffany, he said with a slight exhalation, as if he were relieved to be here too. He and Clementine were like people arriving at a wake after a funeral, ready to unloosen ties and let the tension drain from their shoulders, desperate to eat and drink and remind themselves that they were alive. He hunkered down at the knees and fondled Barney's ears, and Barney reacted with no dignity whatsoever, throwing himself on the ground and offering up his stomach for a rub, as if no one had ever paid him any attention before.
We appreciate your hospitality. Oliver shook Vid's hand and then awkwardly kissed Tiffany too, as if he'd been issued a challenge not to let any part of his body touch hers.
Come in, come in,
Vid shepherded the group inside.
Let's have a drink before we go out to the barbecue.
I'm sorry the little girls are dropping glitter everywhere, said Erika, watching Dakota lead the girls upstairs, followed by Barney, who was now in a state of manic excitement.
Tiffany saw an irritated spasm cross Clementine's face, presumably because another woman was apologising for her children.
Oh, it's fine, she said.
I set up a craft table for them, said Erika. We thought they were doing crafts, but they were really just making a terrible mess, finished Clementine.
But she and Erika were both smiling now, as if it were funny. Tiffany considered herself a pretty good judge of character and situations. Her instincts were normally spot on, but right now these four had her bamboozled. Were they friends or enemies?
We brought champagne.
Clementine held a bottle of Moët aloft with the sparkly pride of someone who doesn't buy Moët very often. Vid had three cases in the cellar.
Thank you. You didn't need to do that.
Vid grabbed the champagne bottle in one meaty hand like it was a petrol pump.
But the important question is, Clementine, did you bring your cello?
Of course, said Clementine. She patted her handbag. I never go anywhere without it. It's right here. I've got a fancy new collapsible one.
Vid stared blankly at her handbag for a fraction of a second, and then he roared with delighted laughter.
It wasn't that funny, thought Tiffany.
Vid pointed the bottle of champagne at Clementine like a gun.
You got me! You got me!
Yeah, she's got you all right, thought Tiffany, as she went quick smart to the cupboard for champagne glasses, because Vid was about to open that bottle in his normal jubilant fashion. It was fine that Vid had the hots for Clementine. Tiffany understood that. She kind of liked it. And judging by the way Clementine was touching her hair right now, she kind of liked it too. That was just sex. Sex was easy. What Tiffany didn't understand was the other three people in the room, because as Vid uncorked the bottle with predictable whoa results, and Clementine grabbed two glasses from Tiffany and danced about laughing, trying to catch the spilling, frothing champagne, Oliver, Erica and Sam all watched Clementine. And Tiffany couldn't tell, with any of them, if it was with deep affection or utter contempt.
Chapter 21. Clementine placed her book face down on her lap in the circle of lamplight reflected on the duvet. She listened to the rain and looked at the dark, empty side of their double bed. When Sam had come back from his drive after her mother had gone home, "Another time," she'd said robustly. "We'll try again another time." They hadn't said a word about their disastrous night out. They'd been polite and cool to each other, like not especially friendly flatmates. "There is some leftover pasta in the fridge." "Good, I might have some." "I'm off to bed." "Good night." "Good night."
Sam had gone off to the study to sleep on the sofa bed that gave whoever slept on it a sore lower back.
"It was fine, fine," guests would always assure them the next morning, discreetly massaging their lower backs. It appeared the study was Sam's bedroom now. They didn't even go through the pretense of starting out in the same bed, and then one of them creeping off in the middle of the night, pillow under the arm. "We sleep in separate rooms now." It gave her a shocked, sick feeling when she actually let the thought crystallize like that. The last time she and Sam had slept a proper, full, ordinary night together in this bed, a night without twisted sheet dreams or teeth grinding or tossing and turning, was the night before the barbecue. It seemed extraordinary now to imagine them going to bed, sleeping through the night, and waking up together in the morning. What had that last night of extraordinary ordinariness been like? She couldn't remember a single thing about it, except that she knew they'd been so different from the people they were now, just 8 weeks later. Did they have sex? Probably not. They so rarely got around to it. That's why they were so susceptible that night. To the sex. Her mother would have been hoping that tonight's dinner at the fancy restaurant would have resulted in them coming home and making love. If they hadn't come home early, if they'd walked in the door holding hands, Pam would have slipped off quickly with a wink-wink, nudge-nudge smile, and then she would have called the next day and said something horrifically inappropriate like, "I do hope you weren't too tired to make love, darling. A healthy sex life is crucial for a healthy marriage." It would have made Clementine want to put her fingers in her ears and chant, "La, la, la,"
as she used to do when her mother delivered sex education lectures while she drove Clementine and Erica to parties. Erica, who practically took notes every time Clementine's mother opened her mouth, used to listen attentively to the lectures and ask very specific procedural questions. When exactly does the condom go on? When the boy's penis, la, 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 Clementine would yell. Her mother had always been far too open and jolly about sex, as if it were something good for you, like water aerobics. She used to have the joy of sex sitting unabashedly on her bedside table, as if it were a nice novel. Clementine chiefly remembered the hairiness of that book. Clementine wanted sex to be something subtle and secret. Lights off. Mysterious. Hairless. An image came to her of Tiffany in that crazy backyard before all the fairy lights came on. Tiffany's t-shirt, bright white in the hazy light. A sweet taste filled Clementine's mouth. It was the taste of Vid's dessert. Now it was the taste of shame. Two or three nights after the barbecue, Clementine had dreamed she was having sex on stage at the Opera House concert hall with someone who was not Sam. Holly and Ruby were in the audience watching their mother have sex with some other man. Right there in the front row, legs swinging, while Clementine moaned and groaned in the most depraved way, and at first they just watched with blank concentration, like they were watching Dora the Explorer. But then they started to cry, and Clementine called out, "Just a minute," as if she were finishing the washing up, not her orgasm. And then her parents and Sam's parents, all four of them, came running down the aisle of the concert hall with disgusted faces, and Clementine's mother screamed, "How could you, Clementine? How could you?" It wasn't a hard dream to interpret. In Clementine's mind, what happened would forever be tied up with sex. Skanky, sleazy sex. Fragments of that revolting dream had lingered for days, as if it had been an actual memory. She had to keep reassuring herself, "It's okay, Clementine. You never actually performed a sex show at the Opera House with your kids in the audience." It still felt more like a memory than a dream. They'd both had bad dreams that first week after the barbecue. Their sheets got tangled, their pillows stank of sweat. Sam's shouts would violently wrench her awake, as though someone had grabbed her by her shirt front and yanked her upward to a sitting position, her heart hammering. Sam would be sitting up next to her, confused and gibbering, and her first instinctive reaction would always be pure rage, never sympathy. Sam had begun grinding his teeth while he slept, an unbearable melody in perfect three-quarter time. Click, two, three, click, two, three. She would lie there, eyes open in the darkness, counting along for what seemed like hours at a time. Apparently Clementine had started talking in her sleep. Once she'd woken up to find Sam leaning over her shouting. He said he wasn't shouting, but he was. "Shut up, shut up, shut up!" Whoever got the most frustrated would leave to sleep or read in the study. That's when the sofa bed got made up and stayed made up. Eventually they'd have to talk about it. It couldn't go on forever, could it? Don't think about it now. It would sort itself out. She had other, more important things to worry about. For example, tomorrow she needed to call Erica and arrange to see her for a drink after work. Then she would tell her that, of course, she would donate her eggs. It would be her pleasure, her honour. For some reason, a memory came to her of her first and only time she'd seen inside Erica's childhood home. They'd been friends for about 6 months, and Clementine was always, mostly at her mother's insistence, inviting Erica over to play, but the invitation was never returned, and Clementine, with a child's well-developed sense of fairness, was getting sick of it. It was fun going to other people's places. You often got treats you weren't allowed at your own place. So why was Erica being so strange and secretive and, frankly, selfish? Then one day, Clementine's mother was driving them both to some school picnic and they'd stopped at Erica's place to quickly pick up something she'd forgotten. A hat? Clementine couldn't remember. What she did remember was jumping out of the car and running after her to tell Erica Mum said to bring a warm top as well because it was getting chilly, and how she'd stopped in the hallway of the house, bewildered. The front door wouldn't swing all the way open. Erica must have turned sideways to get through. The door was blocked by a ceiling-high tower of overflowing cardboard boxes. "Get out of here! What are you doing here?" Erica had screamed, suddenly appearing in the hallway, her face a frightening, grotesque mask of fury, and Clementine had leapt back. But she'd never forgotten that glimpse of Erica's hallway. It was like coming upon a slum in a suburban home. The stuff. Skyscrapers of old newspapers, tangles of coat hangers and winter coats and shoes, a fry pan filled with bead necklaces, and piles of bulging, knotted plastic bags. It was like someone's life had exploded. And the smell of rot and mould and decay. Erica's mother, Sylvia, was a nurse, supposedly a perfectly capable one. She held down a job at a nursing home for years before she retired. It seemed so extraordinary to Clementine that someone who lived like that could work in healthcare, where things like cleanliness and hygiene and order mattered so much. According to Erica, who was now able to freely discuss her mother's hoarding, it wasn't that unusual. In fact, it was quite common for hoarders to work in the healthcare industry. They say it has something to do with them focusing on taking care of others so they don't take care of themselves, Erica said. And then she added, or their children. For years, Erica's mother's problems had been something they all referred to obliquely and delicately, even when those shows started appearing on TV and they suddenly had a word for the horror: hoarding. Erica's mum was a hoarder. It was a thing, a condition. But it wasn't until Erica had started with her lovely psychologist about a year ago that Erica herself had begun saying the word hoarding out loud and discussing the psychology behind it in this strange, new, clipped way, as if it had never been a deep, dark secret at all. How could Clementine begrudge sharing her home and her life with Erica after she'd seen her home? She couldn't. And yet, she did. It was the same now. She hadn't become a good person. She still didn't feel pleasure at the thought of helping her friend achieve her deepest desire. In truth, she still felt the same overwhelming aversion as when they'd first asked her to donate her eggs. But the difference was that now she relished her aversion. She wanted the doctors to cut her open. She wanted them to remove a piece of herself and hand it over to Erica. Here you go. Let's balance the scales. She turned out her lamp and rolled over to the middle of the bed and tried to think about anything, anything at all, other than that day. That so-called ordinary day. Chapter 22, The Day of the Barbecue. Erica watched Clementine try to rescue the moe that was foaming and frothing from the bottle, while Vid stood in the middle of his gigantic kitchen, the champagne held aloft in both hands, grinning idiotically like a Formula One winner posing for a photo. Clementine laughed, as if it were all a great hoot, as if it didn't matter that expensive champagne was being wasted. She shouldn't have spent that much. It wasn't necessary to turn up to a backyard barbecue with French champagne. She and Sam always lived beyond their means. The mortgage on their damp little trendy place. Erica and Oliver couldn't believe it when they heard how much they'd borrowed, and then they'd taken the little girls off for a holiday in Italy last year. Fiscal madness. They'd put the trip on their credit card, even though the children would have been just as happy with a one-hour drive to the Central Coast. But only Tuscany would do for Sam and Clementine. That's why Clementine really needed to get the full-time orchestra job. She always got herself worked up over auditions, suddenly doubting herself. Erica couldn't imagine having a job where you doubted your ability to perform it. In Erica's world, you were either qualified for a job or you weren't. Perhaps Erica had misinterpreted the expression on Clementine's face. It wasn't that she didn't want to help them by donating her eggs, it was just that she had so much on her mind at the moment. They should have waited until after the audition to ask her, but that was months away. If she got it, she'd be starting a new job. If she didn't get it, she'd be devastated. It was now or never. Maybe it was never. Was that tablet she'd taken affecting her balance? No, of course it wasn't. She was fine. Here you go. Clementine handed Erica a glass, not quite meeting her eyes. I'll have one of those too, said Oliver. His disappointment with the way their meeting had turned out tugged at the corners of his mouth, so he looked like a sad clown. He'd been so hopeful about today. Do you think she'll say yes? He'd said suddenly last night as they watched TV. And Erica could hardly bear the yearning in his voice, and her fear made her snap. How would I know? Yeah, I'll have a drink too, said Sam. It was like everyone was dying of thirst. Erica had served sparkling mineral water at her place with lemon. She took a big mouthful of champagne. She wasn't that fond of it. Did everyone just pretend to like champagne? Well, I know it's not very classy of me, but I'm having a beer. Tiffany went to the giant stainless steel refrigerator and stood with her hip jutted at an angle. She wore denim jeans, faded to almost white, with rips at the knees. They were plausible rips. Erica could almost forgive her for them. And a plain white t-shirt. And her long blonde hair had that just-off-the-beach look that movie stars favoured. Just looking at Tiffany made Erica think about sex, so God knew what she was doing to the men. Although, when she looked at her own husband, she saw that Oliver was looking out the window, staring at nothing, dreaming of babies. The perfect husband. Just in need of a perfect wife. Actually, I'll have a beer. Sam put down his champagne glass on the island bench, if one is going. I've got some strucchi in the oven. Just 5 more minutes, said Vid. He opened the oven and peered in. It's a savoury cheese strudel. Very good. Slovenian, an old family recipe. No. Not really. I got it from the internet. He roared with laughter. My auntie used to make it, and I asked my mother for the recipe, and she said, how would I know? My mother, she's no cook. Me, I'm a great cook. He is a great cook. Very humble, too. Tiffany tipped back her head and took a long swig of her beer. Her back arched, her chest thrust out, like a girl in a sexist football commercial. Erica couldn't look away.
Did she do it on purpose? It was extraordinary.
Erica caught Clementine's eye, and Clementine raised one eyebrow back at her, and Erica tried not to laugh. And everything Erica cherished about their friendship was encapsulated in that secret, just for her, raised eyebrow.
I'd love a husband who cooked, said Clementine to Tiffany. Where did you pick him up?
That would be telling, said Tiffany sparkily. See, this was the sort of conversation Erica didn't get. Wasn't that kind of inappropriate? Flirtatious? And Clementine and Tiffany were being so familiar with each other, as if Erica were the outsider and Clementine and Tiffany were the old friends.
Hey, I cook.
Sam flicked Clementine's shoulder.
Ow,
said Clementine. She said to Tiffany and Vid, the truth is we share the cooking, but neither of us is very good at it.
What? Said Sam with mock outrage. What about my signature dish?
Your shepherd's pie? It's amazing, exquisite. You follow the instructions on that packet mix to the letter. Clementine put her arm around his waist.
And also this. She didn't get this. How could they be teasing each other so fondly after all the tension at Erica's place?
Tension caused by Erica, but really, Clementine and Sam should have been on the same page about something as significant as whether or not they were going to have a third child. It should have been clarified, discussed. Clementine should not have been going around telling people she'd rather poke her eyes out so that people thought they could rely on that information, thank you very much. Was all this lovable banter for the benefit of Vid and Tiffany? She and Oliver didn't do married couple banter. Oliver spoke fondly but politely to Erica in public, as if she were a beloved aunt, perhaps, not his wife. People probably thought they had a terrible marriage.
Let me top you off there, said Tiffany to Erica, holding up the champagne bottle.
Oh, gosh, that went down fast. Erica looked at her empty glass, mystified.
I wonder if I should go check on the kids, said Sam. He looked up at the ceiling. It sounds suspiciously quiet up there.
Ah, relax. Don't worry. They're fine with Dakota, said Vid.
Sam is the worrier, said Clementine.
Yes, Clementine prefers the free-range parenting approach, said Sam. No need to watch them at the shopping centre. A security guard will take care of them.
Sam, that happened once, protested Clementine.
I turned my back on Holly for 1 second in JB Hi-Fi, she said to Vid and Tiffany, although Erica didn't remember hearing this story before, and she'd run off to find a Barbie DVD or something and got disoriented and wandered out of the shop. It was terrifying.
Yes, see, so that's why you can't turn your back, said Sam. Yes, Mr. Never made a mistake in your life.
Clementine rolled her eyes. Never made that sort of mistake, said Sam.
That's nothing. I lost at the Dakota at the beach once, said Vid.
Erica and Oliver exchanged looks. Were these parents trying to outdo each other with just how incompetent and irresponsible they were? When Oliver and Erica had a child, it would never be out of their sight. Never. They would risk assess every situation. They would give their child all the attention they hadn't got from their own parents. They would do everything right that their parents had got wrong.
I have never been so scared in my life as that day at the beach, said Tiffany. I wanted to kill him. I thought to myself, if something has happened to Dakota, I will kill him. I will literally kill him. I will never forgive him.
But look, I'm still alive. We found her. It all worked out fine, said Vid. Kids get lost. It's a part of life.
No, it's not, thought Erica. No, it's not, said Tiffany, echoing Erica's thoughts. It's not inevitable.
Agreed.
Sam clinked his beer bottle against Tiffany's. Geez, these feckless partners of ours.
You and me, we are the feckless ones, said Vid to Clementine, and he made feckless sound like a delicious way to be.
We're relaxed, said Clementine. Anyway, it happened once, and now I watch them like a hawk.
What about you two, eh?
Said Vid to Erica and Oliver, perhaps noticing that his neighbours were being left out of the conversation.
I watch Erica like a hawk, said Oliver unexpectedly. I haven't lost her once.
Everyone laughed, and Oliver looked triumphant. He couldn't normally pull off a clever comeback.
Don't ruin it, my love, thought Erica, as she saw Oliver's mouth move in preparation to speak again. Stop there. Don't try to say the same thing again a different way to get a bigger laugh.
But what about kids, eh? Said Vid. Are you two planning to have children?
There was a brief pause, a tightening, a constriction of the atmosphere, as if people had stopped breathing.
Vid, said Tiffany, you can't ask people that. It's personal.
What? Why not? What's personal about children?
Vid looked nonplussed. We're hoping to have children, said Oliver. His face collapsed inward, like a popped balloon. Poor Oliver. So soon after his tiny social triumph.
One day, said Erica.
Everyone seemed to be deliberately not looking at her, the way people did when you had food in your teeth and they didn't want to tell you, so they kept trying not to see. She used her fingernail to check her teeth for sesame seeds from the crackers. She'd meant to sound upbeat and positive.
One day soon.
Yes, but you can't wait too long, said Vid.
For God's sake, Vid, said Tiffany.
There was a piercing yell from upstairs. Chapter 23. It's Clementine. The rain was so loud right now, Erica could only just distinguish Clementine's voice on the phone.
Speak up, she said. Sorry, it's Clementine. Good morning, how are you?
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Erica moved her mobile phone to the other ear and tucked it against her shoulder so she could continue taking things from the house through to the garage to pack in the car.
I wondered if you wanted to meet up for a drink after work, said Clementine. Today, or another day?
I'm not going to work, said Erica. I'm taking the day off. I have to go to my mother's house.
When she'd called the office, she had told her secretary to tell anyone who asked that she'd taken the day off because her mother was ill, which was technically true. There was a pause.
Oh, said Clementine, and her tone changed, as it always did when they talked about Erica's mother. She became tentative and gentle, as if she were talking to someone with a terminal disease.
Mum did mention that she called you last night.
Yes, said Erica.
She felt a tiny eruption of fury at the thought of Clementine and her mother talking cosily about her. Poor, poor Erica, as they must have done since she was a child. She said to Clementine, how was dinner?
Great, said Clementine,
which meant that it wasn't, because otherwise she would have rhapsodized about the amazing flavors of the such and such.
Well, don't tell me about it then, Clementine. I don't care if your marriage is falling apart, if your perfect life is not so perfect these days. See how the rest of us live.
So you're going to your mother's place, said Clementine, to
help her clean?
As much as I can.
Erica picked up the 3-litre container of disinfectant and put it down again. It was too hard to carry while she tried to talk on the phone. She picked up the 2 mops instead and walked through the connecting door to the garage, switching on the light as she did. Their garage was spotless, like a showroom for their spotless blue Statesman.
Has Oliver taken the day off work too?
Clementine knew that Oliver always went with her. Erica remembered when she told Clementine about the first time Oliver had helped with her mother's house and how wonderful he'd been, just getting the job done, never a word of complaint, and how Clementine had got such a soft, teary look on her face when she heard this. And for some reason, that soft, teary look made Erica feel angry. Because she already knew how lucky she was to have Oliver's help. She already felt grateful and cherished. But Clementine's reaction made her feel ashamed, as if Erica didn't deserve it, as if he were doing more than anyone could expect of a husband.
Oliver is home from work, but he's sick, said Erica.
She opened the boot of her car and slid in the mops.
Oh, well, do you want me to come with you today? Said Clementine. I could come. I'm playing at a wedding this morning, but then I'm free until school pickup time.
Erica closed her eyes. She could hear notes of both hope and fear in Clementine's voice. She remembered Clementine as a child, the day she'd discovered the way Erica lived. Sweet little Clementine, with her porcelain skin, her clear blue eyes, and her clean, lovely life, standing at Erica's front door, her round eyes even rounder still.
You'd get bitten, Erica told her bluntly. There are fleas.
Clementine's porcelain skin always got the first mosquito bite. She looked so juicy.
I'd wear repellent, said Clementine enthusiastically.
It was almost like she wanted to come.
No, said Erica, no. I'm fine. Thank you. You should be practicing for your audition.
Yes, said Clementine with a sound like a sigh. You're right, I guess.
Who has a wedding on a Wednesday morning? Said Erica. Mostly to change the subject, but also because part of her didn't want to hear what she could sense was coming. Don't all the guests have to take time off work?
People who want to save money, said Clementine vaguely. And it's outdoors and they didn't have a wet weather plan, of course. Anyway, listen, I didn't want to do this over the phone, but
here it came, the offer. It had only been a matter of time. Erica walked back inside and studied the huge bottle of disinfectant.
I know you probably haven't wanted to bring it up again since the barbecue, said Clementine. I'm sorry it's taken me so long to get back to you.
She sounded incongruously formal.
But I didn't want you to think it was just because... Her voice wavered. And obviously, Sam and I, we haven't been thinking straight.
Clementine, said Erica, you don't have...
So I want to do it, said Clementine. Donate my eggs, that is. I want to help you have a baby. I'd love to help. I'm ready to, you know, get the ball rolling.
She cleared her throat self-consciously, as if the words get the ball rolling were in a foreign language she was only just learning.
I feel good about it.
Erica didn't say anything. She managed to heft the bottle of disinfectant up onto her hip, like an obese toddler. She staggered back out to the garage.
I want you to know that my decision has got nothing to do with what happened, said Clementine. I would have said yes anyway.
Erica grunted as she opened the passenger door of her car and dropped the disinfectant onto the seat.
Oh, Clementine,
she said, and she was conscious of the sudden candidness of her tone,
as if she'd been speaking falsely up until now. This was her true voice. It echoed around the garage. This was the voice she used with Oliver in the middle of the night when they shared the most shameful secrets of their shameful childhoods. We both know that's a lie. Chapter 24. The Day of the Barbecue.
That sounds like Holly, said Sam. He put down his beer bottle. I'll go.
Oh, dear, said Tiffany. I'll show you where they are.
Mummy!
Holly shrieked from upstairs.
Mummy! Mummy! Mummy!
Looks like I'm needed too, said Clementine, with obvious relief.
Erica wanted to go too, to check if Holly was okay, but with both parents there, it was clearly not appropriate and would be the sort of overstepping behaviour that would earn Erica an exasperated sigh from Clementine. Now it was just Erica, Oliver, and Vid in the room, and it was immediately obvious that this particular social combination didn't work, even though Vid, of course, would give it his ebullient best shot. Oliver stared glumly into his champagne glass while Vid opened the oven door to check on his baking and closed it again. Erica looked around for inspiration. There was a large glass bowl in the middle of the island bench filled with different sized, different coloured pieces of glass. This is pretty, she said, pulling it towards her to examine the contents.
It's Tiffany's, said Vid. She calls it sea glass. I call it rubbish.
He picked up a long, oval-shaped piece of dark green glass.
Look at this. I said to her, Babe, this is from a broken Heineken bottle. Some drunk leaves it at the beach, and then you bring home his rubbish. She goes on about it being polished by the sea, or whatever.
I guess it makes a nice decoration, said Erica, although she agreed with him. It was a bowl of rubbish.
She's a hoarder, my wife, continued Vid. If it wasn't for me, she'd be like one of those people you see on TV. You know, those ones who have so much crap that can't get out their front door.
Tiffany isn't a hoarder, said Erica. Oliver cleared his throat. A little warning bell.
She is. She really is, said Vid. You should see her wardrobe, her shoes. That woman is Imelda Marcos.
She's not a hoarder, though, said Erica. She avoided looking in Oliver's direction.
My mother is a real hoarder.
Oliver held out his hand, palm down in front of Erica, as if to stop a waiter refilling his glass, except instead of no more wine, he meant no more sharing. In Oliver's world, you told no one anything. Family was private. Family was shameful. They had that in common, except that Erica no longer wanted to be ashamed.
Like, for real? Said Vid, interested. Like, on the TV shows?
The TV shows. Erica remembered the first time she'd turned on the TV and seen her mother's hallway, there for the world to see in all its disgusting glory, and how she'd leapt back, both hands pressed to her chest, as if she'd been shot. It was like something from a nightmare. An enemy had filmed her dirty secret and broadcast it. Her rational mind had worked it out in the next instant. Of course it wasn't her mother's hallway. It belonged to an elderly Welshman on the other side of the world. But even then, Erica still couldn't shake that feeling of exposure, of public humiliation, and she turned it off with an angry swipe of the remote, as if she were slapping someone's face. She'd never watched one of those shows the whole way through. She couldn't bear that glib, pseudo-sympathetic tone.
Yes. For real, said Erica, like on the TV shows.
Wow, said Vid.
She has a pathological attachment to inanimate objects, Erica heard herself say. Oliver sighed.
She accumulates stuff to insulate herself from the world, continued Erica.
She couldn't stop.
For most of her life, she had avoided analyzing her mother's habit or even thinking about it much, except when absolutely necessary. It was as though her mother had a socially unacceptable fetish. When she had left home, she was able to detach herself further still. But then, one night, about a year ago, Erica had typed the word hoarder into Google. And just like that, she had developed a voracious appetite for information. She read textbooks, journal articles, and case studies, initially with a racing heart, as if she were doing something illegal. But as she accumulated facts and statistics and terms like pathological attachment to inanimate objects, her heart slowed. She wasn't alone. She wasn't that special. There was even a Children of Hoarders website where people like Erica shared story after story of identical frustrations. Erica's entire childhood, which had once seemed so unique in its secret, dirty shame, was nothing more than a category, a type, a box to be ticked. It was all that research that had led to her decision to get counselling.
My mother is a hoarder, she'd said to the psychologist at her very first session, the moment she sat down, as dispassionately as if she were saying, I have a bad cough, to her GP.
It had been exhilarating, as if she'd once had a fear of heights and now she was skydiving. She was talking about it. She was going to learn tips and techniques. She was going to repair herself like a broken appliance. She'd be as good as new. No more anxiety over visiting her mother. No more waves of panic when some smell or word or passing thought reminded her of her childhood. She'd get this sorted. The exhilaration had diminished a little when it had turned out the repair process wasn't quite as speedy or systematic as she'd hoped, but she was still optimistic, and she still felt it was a sign of her good mental health that she could discuss her mother's problems so freely now. It's not a sign of mental health, Oliver had said once, with unusual irritability, after Erica had begun telling an old lady in a supermarket checkout queue exactly why she needed to buy so many heavy-duty garbage bags. It makes you look unstable. Oliver didn't understand that Erica experienced a strange, wondrous pleasure in telling on her mother. I'm not keeping your secrets any longer, Mum. I'm reporting you to this nice little old lady in the shopping centre. I'm reporting you to whoever cares to listen. Vid seemed fascinated, intrigued.
Wow, he said. So she just can't throw anything out, eh? I remember on one of those shows I watched, this old fella, he kept newspapers, right? Piles of them. And I just thought, mate, what are you doing? You'll never read them. Chuck them in the bin.
Well, said Erica.
Chuck what in the bin?
Tiffany reappeared with Dakota, who appeared so colourless and ordinary, standing next to her vibrant mother, and Holly, who seemed to be bright-eyed and bushy-tailed after all that yelling. She could be a drama queen.
Everything okay? Said Erica.
Oh, yes, all good, said Tiffany. Holly just had a bump playing tennis on the Wii.
Did a tennis ball hit your nose? Oliver asked Holly.
It was like the whole shape and texture of his face changed when he spoke to children, as if he stopped clenching his teeth or something.
Oliver, the tennis balls are not technically real, said Holly.
She held up two fingers on each hand to place inverted commas around the word real.
Oliver slapped the side of his head.
Silly me.
Ruby's head went wham against my nose.
Holly rubbed her nose resentfully, remembering.
She has a super hard head.
Ouch, said Oliver. Dakota is going to take Holly to show her the little house where Barney sleeps, said Tiffany.
I want a puppy for my birthday, said Holly, exactly like Barney.
We'll give you Barney, said Vid. He is very naughty.
Really? Said Holly. Can I have him?
No, said Dakota. That's just my dad being silly.
Oh,
said Holly, and she threw Vid a baleful look. Maybe I'll get her a puppy for her birthday, thought Erica. She'd tie a red ribbon around its collar, and Holly would throw her arms around her, and Clementine would smile indulgently and fondly. Was she drunk? Her thoughts seemed to keep skidding off in all kinds of hysterical directions.
Oh, dear. Oh, well, I'll let your mum and dad deal with that, said Tiffany.
She lifted her T-shirt and scratched her flat, tan stomach.
And then we should all move out to the cabana, don't you think, Vid? It's too nice to be inside. Is that strudel finally ready?
What are Clementine and Sam doing? Asked Erica.
Ruby wanted them to try to play tennis with her on the Wii, said Tiffany. She's too little for it, really. And then I think they forgot Ruby and started to get competitive with each other.
Ruby needs her nappy changed, confided Holly to Erica.
She waved a hand in front of her nose.
They'll need the bag then, said Erica, picking up Clementine's nappy bag.
It was so typical of Clementine and Sam to start playing some computer game while their child needed changing, and they were visiting people they barely knew. They were like teenagers sometimes.
I'll take it up. It's the room at the end of the hallway.
Tiffany's tone became abruptly sharp.
Not on the marble!
She spun Vid back toward the stove just before he dumped a hot baking dish on the island bench. Erica put the bag over her shoulder and walked up the softly carpeted, curved staircase. At the top of the stairs,